coming to get you, Barbara. They're coming for you, Barbara. Look, there comes one of them now.
Welcome to the latest episode of the Movie Breakdown. And I don't know about you, but where I am, we might have some lightning. We might have some thunder. It might be a spooky episode of the Movie Breakdown, as you have hear crackling in the background. Or at least that's what it was on my walk home. Start the podcast. Maybe all the danger has been averted. But hopefully you are in a comfortable, nice place and ready to sit down and listen to some movie talk. We've got 5 movie reviews for you, including the big Viola Davis starring picture set in a historic time in Africa in The Woman King. We also got ourselves sort of a dramedy set in high school in Do Revenge. I'm Christopher Spicer.
And I'm Scott Martin. This is the Movie Breakdown. We are going to be talking about 5 films, like Chris said. But first, we just want to give a shout out to Spreaker Prime. That is the site that hosts our podcast, as well as many other amazing podcasts. As well, it's brought to you by our pop culture site, Beyond the Balcony, where you can access by going to beyondbalcony.com. There's some really fun things up from this week, especially my favorite, Chris writing about a topic that we've enjoyed here on the I shouldn't say enjoyed, we usually rant about it, but when people pass off movies as not being horror films just because they don't want to admit to having liked a horror film. So he's got a great article on that called "Is It Actually a Horror Movie?" And I do say check it out because it's a lot of fun.
There are some movies in there that I do have to concede are not horror movies, but some, which apparently are considered by some non-horror, I was shocked and said, I've always seen that as a horror movie. Fun enough, after I posted that, one of our longtime listeners left a Facebook comment essentially kind of teasing, saying, "Didn't you mean to say elevated horror?" So he listens to us. He basically says that apparently he has been, our conversations about horror, he's been talking about other friends about sort of our stance on horror and that idea. And so he's decided, he's told me that apparently he's going to send that article off to them so they can get a better idea of where we stand. So we're preaching the goods of horror.
Indeed. I was baffled. 10 Cloverfield Lane. Some people don't see that as a horror.
Well, yeah, if you see my write-up, it's essentially me saying, wait, what, huh? Like,
yeah.
Who are these people that say this is not a horror movie? Tell me an element here that isn't from horror. She wakes up chained to a bed.
She's abducted.
Trying to wonder what's happening. A guy slowly goes more and more insane. Those things happen in horror movies.
While alien monsters murder everything on the surface of the planet. Yeah, it was an interesting one. Anywho, we're not talking about that movie today. One of the films we are talking about is a high school comedy coming of age film. You could use a lot of different words to describe it. You could say that there are a lot of cliches in this film. This is Do Revenge, and it is directed by Jennifer Caitlin Robinson. It stars Camila Mendes as Drea and Maya Hawke as Eleanor. And right from the very beginning, we definitely get a sense that this is inspired or shaped by a lot of teenage high school comedies, as we get the ever so overused, you know, someone getting new student getting a tour of the school. Oh, those are jocks. You don't want to hang out with the jocks because, you know, on Sundays they get into flower fights where they go to the bakery and throw flour, or those are the drama nerds. You know, you get that tour through the school where you see all the cliches of cliques. This story has Maya Hawke as Eleanor being the new girl to a school, and she ends up getting a transformation to infiltrate the cool kids at the school. Once again, this is highlighting other works and Camila Mendes playing Drea. She wants revenge because someone nasty, her ex-boyfriend Max, played by the sleazy ex-boyfriend Max, played by Austin Abrams, he did something to humiliate her. So there is, this movie is just chock full of all these teenage high school tropes that we've seen. And also we get basically a throw mama from the, or off the train, throw mama from the train. Anyways, mama's getting thrown because these two people realize if they do revenge for the other person, there's no way that stuff can lead back to them. And obviously throw mama from the train was earlier ripped off in like 1950 by Alfred Hitchcock. So that idea has been around as well. And so you've got this film that is setting up all this stuff, and even the characters in the school, this is a very preppy, expensive, rich kid school, and everything in it is pretty much hyperbolic. And what really makes this film different is that it turns out our leads are sociopaths. And so Jennifer Caitlin Robinson now is in a position where she is presenting all these different cliches from films, all these tropes, all these ideas that have been around for a while, but now like throwing in this idea of what if you actually hate the lead people in the in this movie? What if they are actually horrible people? And I really, really, really loved this. I thought it was great. I thought it was a neat turn on things, because all of us, you know, in these movies, a lot of times the main person, outside of maybe one thing they do that gets miscommunicated around, you know, the two-thirds mark, other than that, they're squeaky clean people, and we know what resolutions are going to come. But when the two leads are sociopaths, how can you figure out what the resolutions are going to be or understand that? I loved this take on it. For some reason, while I was watching this movie, I had it in my mind that it had a really, really low score on Rotten Tomatoes. And I'm viewing it thinking, well, I love it. I think this is great. I think it's brilliant. It's fresh because it's showing all this stuff that has been around for ages, but still making it, you know, new. And I think I really loved this concept, because it still addresses things like being accepted, being comfortable with who you are, being happy. It still, even though the leads are unlikable people, it still looks at those insanely human needs and wants. And it does it in a very entertaining way. There's some really good humor in here. I think that the performance is are wonderful. And also, you know, it highlights that need for revenge. Instead of people trying to find ways to deal with something horrible that happened to them, you know, it shows what happens, you know, when you decide to go that route of revenge. So it's about dealing with bullies. It's dealing with people who are out to get you in mean ways. And I really, really liked it. I gave it 3.5 stars.
And you mentioned that the picture is very much sort of in the cliches. I do want to mention that one of the reasons why this movie worked for me as well is it leans into them. Like, it does have that, like, oh, let's see the cliches. But they even say something about, like, I'm a 90s girl. I like 90s movies. So yeah, take me on a tour. And sometimes that type of stuff is annoying. But I think the tone they set here, because we have the narrators and the movie establishes very early on that this is a little bit tongue-in-cheek and it's kind of trying to be a bit more kind of satire, that type of stuff just adds to the fun. I appreciate the tone of this. I think the two leads also do a lot of making this movie work a lot for me. With Drea, you got Camila Mendes, where, yes, she's a bit of a sociopath, but there's something charming about that lead that you still kind of want to give her the benefit of the doubt. You still kind of want to connect to her. And I guess she's from Riverdale, so that's one of the things where I guess she's a recognizable name. It's not just Games of Thrones anymore, where it's people I don't recognize and I have to find out what they're from. And then Maya Hawke, I know because I do watch Stranger Things. I've been watching it with Everett, and she's from Stranger Things. I think she came in the second season. No, actually, I think it was the third season. She came to the third season. And she's definitely playing that type of character, that kind of witty character, that character who's sort of a little bit sarcastic. But she plays it really well. And she has some moments of vulnerability here. And so I think that also allowed you to connect to the character, even though she's doing some awful things. I'm also curious of rewatching this movie because there's some different twists and turns. And my feeling is that it will hold up.
Yeah, I think that it will. It's funny you mentioned about how, you know, it used to be that everyone was from Game of Thrones. Oddly, funnily enough, we get a performance in here from Sophie Turner, who was in Game of Thrones and is basically just in it for two small scenes. I don't know if this is just a sign of what happens after a big hit show when you've got a bunch of the actors struggling to keep a name for themselves outside of the show. Like, I think Kit Harington was pitching a Jon Snow Game of Thrones television show. And I don't know if that's because it's just hard to find. And this isn't a criticism on them. This is, you know, a lot of shows when they're popular, people branching out afterwards and having difficulties finding places to grow.
I can't remember how Sophie Turner, where she was on the casting, but I kind of interpreted just because of like her playing kind of a substantial, like even though her character only had two parts, they kind of made them substantial scenes. I saw this more as a cameo. I saw it more as sort of like it was her star power that gave her that role. They're kind of leading it sort of being a bigger name. So I didn't see this as detrimental for her. I thought this was more sort of like, yeah, look, it's Sophie Turner. And then speaking of that, there is a glorious, wonderful, a smaller role in this, which was absolutely perfect. And I'm not going to spoil just because I was surprised by it. I didn't know that she was in this, but she is a definite callback to 1990s. So to me, that even cemented that this was trying to be sort of like a 1990s teen dramedy because she was kind of one of the queens of it.
I know who you're talking about. And it was, I was tickled to see her in the film, and I thought her performance was good. And yeah, like you, it just basically kind of says, yeah, we know what kind of film we're doing, and it all worked here. I loved so much about this movie.
Another thing that I liked about this picture is it's largely kind of played for fun. It's got the laughs, it's got this good spirit to it. And I think that's what helped the revenge plot not being overbearing and also allowing us to sort of, even though these leads are unlikable, it allows us to still kind of be with them because of sort of the fun spirit of the movie. But I do like the fact that it didn't get afraid to tackle big things. Like, this movie is definitely addressing toxic masculinity and kind of male privilege. And sometimes how we kind of victim shame, like it dealt with that stuff, I thought, in pretty fine. Like, that's a very delicate subject, and it's a hard subject to put into a comedy. But I think they dealt it in a way where when they did address those things, they did address it with seriousness. And so that's kind of where the dramedy part came with. But it never came overbearing to take away the comedy of the thing.
I completely agree. And just one thing, too, about how this movie works, I think, even though that, yeah, from a distance, the leads are not likable and all that. But what makes us connect to them is what they're hurt by is stuff that we would get hurt by. What the, you know, what they got hurt by really does matter. And it is things that are legitimate problems. So it makes it easy for us to still, while we dislike them, to still want to see good come for them, which is always the problem when you have unlikable characters. We still have to want the goodness to happen. And that's the way it is in this film.
Yeah. And not only are they legitimate issues, but they're actually serious issues that are still in society today, to the point of I have nightmares thinking about my daughter becoming a teenager.
Yeah, I can see why. That's why we just have cats. Things are easier on cats.
They don't have to go to high school.
That's right. They don't have to go to high school. They're not going to get peer pressured into, you know, hey man, catnip, all your friends are doing it.
Be that cranky parent. That must be why I only gave this 3 stars. I did enjoy this movie quite a bit. I think maybe it was sort of the routine of it, the predictability of it maybe, that stopped me from going all to 3.5. But I did enjoy this movie a lot, and I probably will revisit it.
That's good. So we're both saying, hey there, people, this is a film to check out.
And to continue on the hey there, people, this is a movie to check out train, I now bring you to The Woman King, who is brought to us by director Gina Prince Bythewood, who did the big Netflix movie Old Guard, which me and Scott weren't totally huge on, but definitely showed that she could sort of handle a budget. Before that, she did Beyond the Lights, Secret Life of Bees, so sort of a lot of smaller pictures. I guess the old In Love and Basketball, which was a really popular romance from about 2 decades ago. But this, like, Old Guard would have been her introduction and sort of doing a more big budget, big scale picture, but it was for Netflix. And then now we have The Woman King, which is based off sort of historical. The kingdom that this movie is based in was a real African kingdom in Dahomey. And the king here, who's played by John Boyega, King Geyso, he existed. And the army of women warriors, the Agaji, they existed. There was a real women warrior empire that existed in Dahomey. But this actual movie is, from what I could tell, not based off any historical event, not in historical reality. And there is things in this movie that go against the facts that we have. But remember, me and Scott love Braveheart. So facts don't matter for a good movie. And this is still a really good movie, even if you're not getting a history lesson. You shouldn't go to the movie theater for your history lessons. You should go to history classes and read history textbooks. Not ones, though, that are supported by Donald Trump. Ones that are real. But basically, this picture, what's interesting about it, as well as watching this, it made me think that I think even a year ago, we were mentioning sort of genres that would never exist again, or type of movies that would never be the big screen. And one of them, I thought, like, well, the historical epic is done. You're never going to see that on the big screen. And then I see this picture, I was like, wow, it can still exist. But what's interesting about it is this is a movie that would have been on the big screen, been a big event like 30 years ago, but not this exact movie. That's the thing that's fascinating. It's 30 years ago, they would not have been doing a historical epic based in Africa with warrior women. That's why it took until 2022. And so it's sort of a throwback movie like a Top Gun Maverick, but it's telling a story that really would have only sort of happened now. And this one is being loved by critics, but it's also really connecting with audiences. This is another one along with sort of Top Gun Maverick, Everything Everywhere All at Once. It's showing you make movies for adults. They could do well in the box office. This got an A-plus cinema score. It made $18 million its opening weekend. And with that cinema score, I think this is going to have crazy legs. I think it's going to do great throughout the September. It's going to get great word of mouth. And so this picture, the star here is Viola Davis. She's General Niniska. Viola Davis is amazing here. She looks incredible shape. I mean, Viola Davis did Suicide Squad. She's been this tough woman before. She definitely knows how to play the intimidating woman. But this time, she looks like a full-on warrior. She's in incredible shape. You believe that this is someone who can lead an army. We start off this picture with this battle at night where she's rescuing a captive from her from her tribe, from her kingdom, and she takes down this other tribe. And it's just a wonderfully choreographed action sequence. It's intense. It's incredible. I think this picture also just really knows how to immerse you into the world. I heard a criticism of the cinematography, and I couldn't disagree more. I'm looking at this, and it's reminding me sort of of Black Panther, where there's these bright, beautiful colors in the village. And I feel that's immersing into African culture. Gorgeous, vibrant costumes, a great use of the lighting and how they shoot the villages and the world in Africa. Just nice, bright, vibrant colors. But then when you have the slave traders come, there is this kind of darker, more muted colors. It kind of shows you that you've got the beautiful, gorgeous kingdoms of Africa, but they're being taken over. They're being tricked by devious figures, and they had these more muted colors to them. And I thought that was fascinating. What we have here, what we learned, and this is a reality that a lot of people maybe don't know, is that a lot of these African empires, they grew through slave trade. Essentially, they captured other kingdoms, and they sold their prisoners to the white slave traders. And so that's a big issue here, because General Naniska disagrees with it. She's telling her king, we should not profit off other humans. We should not profit over our own people. It's that this is our kingdom, but we should profit over other Africans, because the white slave traders don't care about us. And so it's a theme that was probably a reality then, but just one that still that message kind of works today. What is really cool about this picture, one of our characters who sort of is our in into the world is Nawi. And she's this younger girl. She doesn't want to have to follow tradition. She's this kind of tough, spirited girl. She speaks her mind. And this is played by Thuso Mibidu. And she's incredible. This is a breakout performance. Viola Davis is getting praise, and she deserves it. Viola Davis has an amazing presence. She feels like a leader. She's powerful. But you get these moments of her being tormented and torn, and sort of she wants to believe in her king, but there's things she disagrees with. But Thuso Mibidu, this is a discovery. This is a great performance. This is someone who, like I said, she's the audience in. She is someone who we need to connect with. She has these vulnerable moments. She's entering this new world, but she's also sort of this tough spirit and this resolute person. And she has this great presence, and she's got to go toe-to-toe with Viola Davis, which is incredible. What is cool about this is so you sort of see the meshing of matriarchy versus patriarchy, because this kingdom is still ruled by a king, and it's still ruled by this idea that, you know, the families need to get their daughter to a suitor. And the first time we see Nawi is her dad's trying to sell her off to this man to marry her, but she doesn't want to marry him. And she actually punches him. And so the father doesn't know what to do with her and sends her off to the kingdom, gives him to the king. And we find out there's this other world in the kingdom. This is where Viola Davis and her warriors live. And it's the only place where women get to sort of be in charge, where they get to have respect. In the village, it's still, you know, a man's world. It's still patriarchy. But within that kingdom, in the castle, only eunuchs and women are allowed, along with the king. And he has these trusted women warriors that he confides in Viola Davis. And so it's cool to kind of see that different world and seeing a place of why these women want to be warriors, because that's a place where they get to have autonomy, where they get to have choice, where they have independence. And there's several really fascinating warriors here, a lot of great performances, a lot of interesting different characters with each of them. Nawi ends up having a relationship with one, like a friendship, sort of this mentor relationship, which I thought was charming. You kind of believe in it and you're invested in it, and there's some great chemistry with those tender moments. It's a definitely a very kind of predictable, by the beats type of picture. You sort of know sort of the direction where this picture is going to go. But what elevates it is sort of the great action sequences, the gorgeous colors, the great performances from Viola Davis and Thuso Mibidu, and a lot of the supporting cast, the other warriors. There's those great kind of moments. Viola Davis, one of the things sort of with this picture, it's trying to make it more historic and real. And I think that if it went a bit, like she's haunted by these dreams, and she has these visions, Viola Davis, and then there's certain reveals. And I felt like if it almost went a Northman route, if it did a more sort of surreal route, if it did more mythical route, some of the storylines would have connected a bit better, but because it was grounded in reality, it didn't quite work as well. So that was the one thing, but that's not the movie that was made. So I only have to review what I saw. And what I saw was a movie that definitely delivers on the historical epic. It's already clear that this is a crowd pleaser. And I think that's the thing, is this was not trying to be necessarily a challenging picture. This was meant to be as a crowd pleaser. As a crowd pleaser, it delivers. I give this 3.5 stars. It's another one to add to a great year of movies.
It's been a wonderful year of movies, hasn't it? Just tip-top.
This is a tip-top movie. This was some really strong direction. I think it's being touted as a mid-budget movie, which to me shows that Gina Brightwood, knows how to handle a budget, knows how to make stuff look good, because this looks like a big budget spectacle.
I mean, the trailers look phenomenal to me. I wish I was able to see it. I plan on seeing it as soon as I can. Here's the problem. The first time I saw a trailer, I got really into it, and I thought this trailer looks like the kind of one where a movie can go either way. Either it is an incredibly crafted trailer that hides the fact that this is actually a very dumb, awful movie, or it's a trailer that is showing why I should get excited. And so when we talk about movies that are most anticipated for us, this was on there because I was mostly just anticipating, like, is it good or is it bad? And I wanted it to be good. And then when I started seeing the reviews come out, I realized, oh goodness, that's good. We don't have just a bad movie with an incredible trailer.
This is one of those interesting movies where you and I, we watch so many movies, and we watch movies in a way to review them. And so we're often looking for things that are sort of different and cutting edge and go against expectations. And this is one of those ones where I really enjoyed this movie, but it's at 3.5 because I sort of was like, oh, it was kind of standard. But watch this, I realized this is going to be a lot of people's favorite movies. There's going to be a lot of women that are going to feel empowered by this movie. Probably a lot of African-American women that are going to be empowered. So it's by the numbers, but it's by the numbers made by experts and made by an Academy Award-winning performance. Like, this is the higher craft. And so this is one of the ones where it's not going to make my favorite movie of the year. It might make my list, but it won't make the number one spot. But I think this is going to be, this is one where I can say without a doubt, this is a crowd pleaser. This is going to have a lot of fans.
Very interesting. I didn't know about this before today, but Maria Bello did this story. This was her first writing.
John Boyega is really good as the king. He's kind of torn, and I think he's got some really great scenes with Viola Davis. He sort of wants to keep slavery, but he also wants to respect Naniska, who is Viola Davis. The person who I said has an interesting sort of relationship with Nawi is played by Lashana Lynch, and she's a Zoggy. I wanted to mention her name. She's kind of like a general, or she's like underneath the general. She's a major part of the army, but she's got a soft spot for Nawi, and I think they've got some really great tender moments, mentor-type stuff. And then Amenza, who's played by Sheila Atom, is sort of the trusted confidant of Naniska, again, played by Davis. And they also have a really great relationship. Like, there is some good character moments here, and there's some really good performances. Like, this is a definite, well-balanced picture. It's got the action, it's got the drama, it's got the character stuff, and it even has some comedy.
That's awesome. All you've done is made me want to see this film more, which is, I suppose, what your goal was, wasn't it?
Yes, which is good, though I feel like when it comes to you, my very good friend, it often is either when I praise movies like this or when I pan movies. Both of those pique your interest in equal measures.
Absolutely, they do. Because for some reason, I want to see just the worst things of the year. He's moving off to a film that landed on this podcast and one that I actually did not like at all. It stars Queen Latifah as Brenda and Ludacris as Reggie, Brenda's brother. And I'm very entertained by both Queen Latifah and Ludacris. I find them to be very charismatic. And unfortunately, what they are is in a movie where script doesn't make anyone smart. We have people who just things that are really, really kind of dumb and mostly just exist to push forward a plot. And the story is that Brenda's husband has died. The medical bills have cancer treatment drained the family's monies, and they've got to move from California to, I believe it's Houston. So off they go on a family road trip. However, staying one night at a hotel, I guess they had to find a new hotel to go to because white supremacists held them up for 5 minutes on a road. So they had to find a new hotel to go to. See, this is the thing. That's what I'm talking about in this movie. You're just kind of like, sorry, what? Is this how it happens? Also, here's a question for you. When you go to a diner and order pancakes and you don't have much money, do you not put syrup on your pancakes because you don't have enough money? Do restaurants actually charge you for the syrup that's on the table and if you use it or not, or if you use butter? Because we get a scene where people, I'm not going to say who, they don't have much money and they're just staring at their plates. Now, they've already paid, obviously the plates are getting paid for, but they don't want to eat the food because they think they have no money. They don't want to use the butter because they think they have no money. And they don't want to use the darn syrup because they think they have no money. There's just things in here that really, really got under my skin. There's things in here that, why didn't you tell these people right away? This is the case, and then the entire problem for you is solved. Anyways, the plot. So they're going to Houston. They stay at this hotel or motel that they didn't intend on staying at. There's a murder next door because Mr. Cross, Brenda tries to save murdered guy's life, and Ludacris finds a bag full of money that was super easy to find that the killer didn't want to find. Anyways, the bag of money gets hidden in another motel. And someone else finds it because they just go into random motels and search closets. I'm trying to give you the plot, but there's an old Western town where there's a shootout and a kid gets abducted and got to get the money to Cross or whatever. I just didn't care. I didn't care about this movie. A lot of the shots and a lot of the editing to me felt like really, really substandard filmmaking. Just some edits where things jumped forward a bit more than you would expect, and you kind of have to place like what happened here. A lot of the camera techniques reminded me of those from the type of film that is just absolutely low budget. This didn't feel like something that Queen Latifah and Ludacris would be in. I should mention Bo Bridges is in here as well. Things sort of bounced around. I felt like the people were idiots. There was not many, many smart people in here. Villains, anyone who's bad is a caricature. Whenever you've got someone or, you know, a movie and like, hey, let's have this person laugh maniacally while they're chasing somebody. That'll make it look really scary because this person's enjoying it. A lot of times that doesn't work because the person looks overly goofy, cannot get engaged with that person because it just doesn't feel anywhere near right. I did not like this movie. There's just so much about it that I couldn't connect to. Give it a really, really low rating of 1 star.
I like this more than you. I was as bothered with some of the plot points. I didn't think they booked a hotel. That's what I thought. Like, she was just okay. There stopping at that point. But anyways, I mean, there's definitely some twists and turns here that just felt very ham-fisted. They bother you. I don't think bother me to the same degree, but there's other things where I could definitely tell this is a weirdly plotted movie. The racist camp was really weird, where then Queen Latifah goes action hero and beats them all up like that. It was really odd. And the reveals at the end definitely don't hold up. But it was one of those unfortunate things of Roger Ebert would say, what was it, the law of economy, I think, or the law of economy of characters. Basically, you know who has to be the bad guy based off what characters are in the movie, unless they pull a cheat. And so like that was kind of disappointing. I called it, but then it didn't make sense to me. The reason why I liked it a bit better than you is I did like Queen Latifah and Ludacris here. I did like their performances. I thought Queen Latifah to be proved. I mean, I'm used to her in dramas. I'm used to her in comedies, and she's really good in them. I thought she was a really good lead in a thriller. If it was a good thriller movie, like if it was well done, I thought she could really pull it off. I believed her emotions. I believed that she thought her kids were in trouble. I believe that she's a mother that would do anything to protect them. So that really elevated the picture out of sort of the worst of the year category for me, because I thought she really brought a lot of emotion, and I thought it... I was able to accept some of the lousy plotting here because I'm with Queen Latifah. I thought that was really strong. I thought Ludacris was really good here too, because he kind of provided the comedy, but not in a way that kind of jarred the picture. I like his interplay with Queen Latifah. I believe that he was a brother that loved his sister. I thought they had a good connection. I thought he did some stupid things, but I kind of realized he was doing it, trying to do the right thing. He's kind of the screw-up brother. So those aspects is why sort of I'm at the two-star category, because I did think there was things that worked. But as an actual thriller, this needed a few more rewrites.
It did need more rewrites. I completely agree. I see your... I understand where you're coming from, because sometimes it's what a character can bring in a story that helps us be immersed to a point where we don't realize all those things. Not that we don't realize, because you still realize them, but they don't bother as much because there's a connection point to the film. I don't really like the Fast and the Furious films, but I like Ludacris in them, right? Like, I think he's really good and has a great screen presence. He's really quite engaging on the screen. Queen Latifah, I do think that you're right. She has shown that she could have a different side to her than we don't normally see because of the comedies, because of the dramas. She is incredibly, incredibly talented. I know we've talked about Hustle quite a bit, but since we're talking about her, I just need to say once again, I think this is one of her best performances. This is a great year for Queen Latifah. Even though she was in a movie I didn't like at all, I can't help but think this is an amazing year for her on account of what she did in Hustle.
Yeah, and my two stars is all on Queen Latifah. I would call this a really good performance in a not very good movie. And so even though I said the things didn't bother you as much, I mean, like, I am confessing that a lot of the thriller aspect didn't work. Like, the KK camp didn't make any sense to me. The bad guy reveal doesn't really make any sense, especially when you find out that, wait, people are scared of him. The biggest one is the one you brought up, is he supposedly is an amazing killer and he didn't check for the money.
I know, it's like... You know, I got to get out of there quick. No, you killed a man with a gun. From what I could tell, he didn't even have to shoot the guy. He's got him pinned against the wall. He could have strangled him. He could have done anything. Got to get out of there. Because, no, you didn't have to use your gun. And guess what? It's a rundown motel in the middle of nowhere. So you could have taken the 15 seconds it takes to check every hiding spot in a horrible motel room.
Like, here's the thing. You're in a rundown hotel. You hear a gunshot. You might, like, the right thing to do is definitely call 911. But you're not running into that room.
It's lights off. Close the curtains. I don't want to, like, I'm not popping my head out. Oh, well, there's better things this week to talk about.
And again, like I said last week, I'm giving it 2 stars. That doesn't mean you should see it.
Exactly.
And now we're moving ourselves over to another dramedy, and a dramedy that I was really interested in seeing, because sort of I think of my own life. And there was a period in 2004 where I was enrolled to actually go with my co-host to a college. And for circumstances, we decided not to go there and was to do a program at the camp I worked at instead. Because I did that program, I believe that's what got me then to get a full-time job there. That full-time job is where I met my wife. meeting my wife means that's who I get married to, and I have my two children. It's one of those crazy things where I thought back while watching this movie. I ended up going to the college instead. My life would have been drastically different. It's very unlikely I'm married to who I am and I have the kids that I have. It's kind of crazy that what seems like a small choice, how little do you know the big impact? And so I was fascinated by this picture, Look Both Ways. It's influenced by sort of that Gwyneth Paltrow movie, Sliding Doors, where it shows she gets on the subway at a time, or what happens if she misses the subway. What was curious about this picture, though, instead of it being a decision, the decision was already made. She decided to sleep with one of her male friends. And then the twist is if she's pregnant or not. But that's a total fate thing. That had nothing to do with her decision. She already made the decision. So what it did was it essentially was like either she's pregnant or not pregnant. That was a curious decision. But I think what it was they did not want to make it about her deciding if she was going to have the baby or not have the baby, because then it would make the movie sort of more challenging. It would bring in some more political issues. It would complicate what they wanted to be a lighter picture. And so they went with the less challenging choice of her just not being pregnant. But then that's what I felt was what hampered this whole picture. It was a movie that plays it safe all the way through. It lacks that idea of complications and actual conflict. It felt like a very safe movie. And so what you had was two sort of very by-the-number movies that were meshed together by a gimmick, rather than two kind of fascinating stories. Because what happens here is her goal is to be an animator. So the world where she is pregnant, she has to move in with her parents. Her friend who they had the baby with, they decide to co-parent, but they're not necessarily in a relationship with. And so it sort of derails her career. So we get that idea of being a parent. But I mean, the most challenging thing she has as a parent is a diaper explodes one night. And as a parent, I'm like, if that's your most challenging thing, like your parenting life is pretty easy. And this is someone in their early 20s, that not quite know what they're doing. There is so many things about parenting that this movie just doesn't bother going. It's kind of, like I said, just very by the numbers. It doesn't really explore that idea of the potential of being a single parent. And I mean, I do think her parents, who she moves in with, they're fine. They have decent chemistry. It's nice to see Luke Wilson, who plays her dad. Andrea Savage plays her mom. I mean, there's elements of them where it's like, oh, that's such the cliche parent reaction. But when the movie gets going, there's some fun little moments there. And then you have the relationship with her or her friend, Gabe. It's fine, but it's just so kind of generic. And you kind of know where it's going. And then the other world is she decides to go to L.A. with her best friend and become sort of try to pursue animation. And so she has this idol that she loves and she looks up to her and she gets hired by her. And it's such a cliche boss of like sort of she's scared to talk to her and she's intimidated for her and she's hard on her. But in the end, you find out she kind of believed in her. Like it's very cliche. And I didn't feel like I learned anything about animation, which we always talk about that with like Chef and these movies where if you're going to be about a field, immerse us in it, make it something interesting. And this could have been any job. She could have been a taxi driver. She could have been a Pog champion. Remember Pog? She could have been in the Pog tour. Like that's what she could have done in this movie. There was just animation didn't really define her in any way. Other than that, she knew animation facts that she spouted out once in a while. That was it. But you didn't really get to see her, see the business. And so both sides, very uncomplicated, very, very little issues. She also finds someone who she has a love interest out there in LA, and then it's long distance. Will they or won't they? But very predictable, very little challenge to the relationship. And I felt a lot of her, the secondary characters, they exist just for her, like her best friend. Enters into a same-sex relationship. You almost know nothing about it. That was just kind of background stuff. It was like, I would have liked these characters to be more defined. I'd be very critical of this movie. Why I went with 2 stars, though, why I didn't go on the lower end is, one, the concept was interesting, and I do think the performances are good. And what really elevated this movie all the way up to a big spanking 2 stars is Lily Reinhart. I think she's got charisma. I think she's got a great screen presence. I've seen her some other pictures, and I'm reminded that she is really good. And she brings emotions that the script don't necessarily bring. The story themselves are generic. She kind of brings the pathos. She brings the energy. She brings the sincerity. I thought she played off everyone really well. So even though I don't think the scripting is strong, I don't think the dialogue is strong, I think those aspects failed her, she got it up to 2 stars. She made it at least watchable.
I agree. She was really good. I would love to say that Danny Ramirez as Gabe was good, but we didn't really see him enough. He should have been in a lot more than he was. He was a distant secondary character outside of the first 15 minutes. Like, he's barely in there at all. It really did feel like, hey, look out how everything is. Since she had to move in with her parents when the baby first came, apparently when the baby's 4 or the kid's 4 or 5 or how old she is, she's still living at her parents. The movie seems to suggest that her life doesn't go anywhere because she has a child, where I can understand for the first year or so maybe, but isn't the fact living with her parents that they can help look after the child so she can go out and have a job or something? So it really didn't make much sense. And the problem, when I use the word gimmick here, that's not an insult to movies that use a gimmick, right? The gimmick is that one moment, what if something turned out differently? And I like what you summed up about how it was not a choice in this moment. It's the fates decided.
I think which is less interesting.
It is. It really is. And, you know, so when you've got this movie gimmick of what would have happened if, the thing is, and I think why some films like this don't work is this, that people forget that both timelines you look at, they need to be compelling. Each story actually needs to be compelling. They're not by default interesting to watch if there's just merely that gimmick in play. That doesn't work. They have to still tell a good story. And I don't think that they do. And Gabe, in the one story or timeline, I guess, or maybe in both, I don't know. I don't care. They both, or his band makes it somewhere and they end up playing at South by Southwest. As far as we can tell, his super hot band that's now playing at South by Southwest is a cover band, because the 2 times we see them perform, they're playing the song We Are Young. And then the second time they were performing it, I'm like, is this a rights thing? Did they just have like the money to get the rights to this? And then, hey, end credits roll and the song We Are Young starts playing. Oh, okay, it was probably a package deal. If anyone who knows anything is looking at this thinking, yeah, an up-and-coming band is not a cover band. I'm sorry. So just like how animation aspect of this film is just sort of throwaway and doesn't live up to the realities of it at all. Yeah, if you're in a cover band, you're playing weddings. You're playing high school dances. You're not an up-and-coming band.
I do agree with your nitpick with the band stuff, because I think it's important, because this movie lacks immersion. It lacks you knowing how the animation industry works. It lacks to showing how the music industry works. And it's like, so why do you have those things in there? They're just there to give them something to do. It could have been anything. None of it feels realistic or immersive. And my biggest issue with this picture is the gimmick is so glaring because of the fact that without the gimmick, you've got 2 dull movies.
Absolutely. And I give this movie 2 stars as well. I think that, like you, I think that anything salvageable in this movie came from Lily Reinhart. She was very, very entertaining. Apparently also from Riverdale. Yeah, I think she was good. And I wish Danny Ramirez was in the film more, because we needed to see the actual impact of what happened. And last thing I'll be nitpicky about, and then I'm ready to move on, is both timelines, she reaches a point where she's like, I'm going to do this. In one timeline, she makes an animated short that gets shown at South by Southwest. I don't know anything about submission process for something like South by Southwest. I'm guessing you don't just make something at home and email it to them, which kind of seems like what happened here. And in the other timeline, she makes Buck. Like, not even a, I don't even know what she made in the other timeline, but she emailed it to South by Southwest and not all, and ended up getting on a panel of experts. Like, I couldn't buy any of this. It takes you out of the experience.
Well, you can't buy any of it because you don't see the scene where she becomes a success, where they decide she's an authority to be on a panel. Like, I mean, you don't have to be the most famous person in the world to be on a panel, but you need to be an authority in your industry. You need to bring some kind of value to the film festival where people would purchase a ticket to watch your panel, and you don't see that. You don't, like, that seems like the moment that made her successful, and you're like, huh? Like what? Like, she's with someone who basically is owning a fictional version of Pixar, though Pixar does exist in this world, but she's like, she's a big head. She's in this panel along with this somebody who hasn't even done animation yet and doesn't have a job. Like, that's a very good nitpick because it makes no sense. And as someone who, like, I don't know how the Brantford Film Festival works, and I'm assuming it's the same as every festival, is essentially you get hundreds of submissions, and then there's essentially juries who decide which movies make the festival. So yeah, it's not like everything that gets made gets in a festival. It's among many things it gets picked. So she would have had to... Yeah, they don't even show that. They don't even show the part where she submits it and then waits to find out she's been accepted. Like, that would have actually been interesting. Yeah.
So what we're saying in general, not a lot interesting.
Is Riverdale the new Games of Thrones?
I guess so, yeah. Riverdale is the new Game of Thrones. If you were in that, you're in pretty much everything at the moment. So now moving on to our last film review, and this is for the movie 13 Lives. This was directed by Ron Howard, and it looks at the incident of the child football team in Thailand that went to celebrate, I believe it was a friend's or one of the teammates' birthdays, by going into a cave. It ended up raining a lot. The cave flooded and they were stuck in there. And it wasn't just that they were stuck in there and it took a long time to rescue them. They were stuck in there and it took a long time to even find them and figure out they're alive. That was the most of their ordeal, was just waiting to be found. And then once they're found, the question was, how do we get them out of here? And the movie, like I said, is directed by Ron Howard. It stars Viggo Mortensen as real-life rescue diver Rick Stanton and Colin Farrell as real-life rescue diver John Valenthan. I think they both give real solid performances. After I watched the film, I ended up watching a National Geographic documentary on it called The Rescue, and you know, seeing the people that they were playing, I think they did a really good job. I think hair and makeup did a fantastic job creating them visually, and their performances took it all the way, based off of a real life event. So there are going to be things that are fictionalized in here, but the interesting thing is almost, and this is air quotes, almost everything plot-wise that does take place happened in real life. Certain things got changed around. Appreciate that Ron Howard tried to focus on more than just British divers, the white saviors that came in, because if this wasn't based off of a real event, I think people would be saying that this, you know, is the white savior film where the people from Britain come in to save them because the Thai people can't save these kids at all. And the fact is just basically just that, you know, the Thai government brought in their Navy SEALs to rescue them, but cave diving is a completely different beast than open water diving or any other type, because there are different concerns, different safety risks, different equipment. It's just completely not the same. So the reality was that these guys from Britain did end up sort of having to take on a lot of the responsibility. That was the reality of it. They were not accepted at first because, you know, they show up, they're older guys, they, you know, they cave dive on weekends. So there was conflict and tension between people at the beginning of who had authority, who was doing what. But what Ron Howard really focuses on is the characters in here. And I wish that this movie was screened in a theater, not because it is some sort of action epic, but is a movie where environment and atmosphere are king and queen. It's getting those underwater shots that make it, you know, put the characters in dark and dangerous places. It's the audio. It's everything about the environment that Ron Howard captures so amazingly that would have made this a very, very, very good film to see in the theater. The acting is really good. Like I said, Ron Howard tries to add aspects to show a grander rescue effort, but ultimately I think the film's failing is that it does, even though they are the main components of the actual story, I think that it does focus on Mortensen and Farrell's characters a bit too much. We've got a side, a very, very, very side plot about people trying to divert rainwater to keep the caves from flooding. It feels really tacked on. There are some aspects of locals that are tacked on, but overall this is a really, really good theater experience that stays fairly true to the actual story. Sadly, when I said theater experience, none of us can see it in the theater, but it felt like that. That's the type of movie that it was. Netflix wishes it had a film like this that had that audio visual element to it to make it that captivating. And on a side note, I was so glad that there was no reference to Elon Musk. All the drama that came out of that, that was a complete sideshow that never should have happened. They focused on the kids. They focused on the rescue. The kids were all sweet. Like, they're just wonderful performances by all the boys. When this story happened, it was riveting in the worst way. And we were watching a movie play out in real life. You know, the story played out actually crazier than I think what we would accept in a Hollywood film. And I was very concerned because right after it happened, after the boys were out, there was like this rush on people trying to get the rights for this film. I knew it wasn't going to get made right away, but people were ravenous about this, about the rights. And you can see why here, because of what a good story it is. I think a lot of that goes to Ron Howard, the technical departments, pretty much everyone involved. I gave it 3.5 stars.
So here's the big question. Is Amazon Studios in the past has released movies theatrically. They did The Big Sick, which came here to Brantford, and there was a few others. That's the big one that I remember, but they definitely have done theatrical before. And now they have bought MGM, so they own MGM Studios, and this was released through sort of their MGM label. And they now own Bond, which clearly will be theatrical. There's no way they're not putting Bond movies in the theater. My question is, do you think like the other ones didn't do as well in the theater? Or why? Because you've already answered the question, if it's at theatrical level, and you're like, this would have been a theatrical experience. So I'm really confused of why they didn't put this in theaters then, especially this summer. And this August, when there was like nothing.
Yeah. And you know, when you talked about the woman queen and you referenced Top Gun as things for the adults, movies that will attract to that older audience, pull them in. I think 13 Lives honestly would have been just a perfect piece of counter programming because we still have in our minds that crazy, crazy incident. Remember it because it basically captivated almost the entire planet. The story was global news. And I really feel like this, could have done well in the theater. Because I'm thinking, was it Manchester by the Sea that... Was that Amazon or was I think
yes.
They had a drama. Yeah. Yeah. They've had a number of films. Also Suspiria. Suspiria went to theaters. I think this one should have, because not only is it, do I think that that was the best place to view it, but I think it could have done really well.
Yeah, because based off two events, historical events usually do well. So, and Amazon also has the money to do advertising. My only guess here is it's a holdover from the pandemic and they didn't have the things put in place yet, where they're still sort of just streaming minded and hopefully sort of seeing how well this did. I would love to see MGM and Amazon Studios to start putting things back in theaters.
Myself as well, because I mean, that's, it's the best place to watch any, even crappy movies, the theater. And I think we talked about this before, if it wasn't for money, literally even the crappiest films of the year, I would watch on the big screen in the theater. It is just the better place to watch stuff.
We would have even watched Spectre on the big screen.
Absolutely. But when it even comes down to if the movie was like $2 or $3, I still think that would have been a steep asking price.
I agree. That was the most non-theatrical quality theatrical blockbuster picture I've ever seen.
Yeah.
So we're not going to do a full-on tribute for this next person, but I thought he needed to at least be acknowledged that he recently passed, and that is Jean-Luc Godard. And the reason why I wanted to mention him is he is one of the major French filmmakers in the New Wave in the 1970s. And another kind of curious thing about him is he started as a film critic. He's one of the most famous film critics turned filmmakers, where he wrote a lot of extensive essays in the 1950s and then basically decided to continue to explore film through his movies. His movies were often about kind of cinema. And he had a very, very long career. Breathless is one of his most popular pictures, kind of a noir. And as well, he did Alphaville, which was sort of kind of a sci-fi caper. And then long later in his career, he did a lot more art house pictures. He definitely got more into the abstract, the surreal, but all his pictures were often kind of exploring cinema. And one of the reasons I want to mention is, one, he basically crafted tons of pictures that are considered very important to cinema, but he was immensely influential to a lot of the filmmakers that we love, like Martin Scorsese, Quentin Tarantino. He definitely, his style can be seen in their filmmaking style. He was very much a huge influence on them. And he is one of the legends. The only reason why we're not doing a tribute is I just have to admit, it's a blind spot. I haven't seen a lot of his movies. And so everything I'd be saying about him wouldn't be coming from the heart. It'd be just coming from research. So you might as well read articles about him from people that actually have experience with him. I need to seek out some of his movies. I need to educate myself, because he is one of the more important filmmakers in cinema history. I have had several of his movies on my PVR. I just have never watched them.
Got to admit, he's a big blind spot for myself as well. It's unfortunate. I think maybe the only Godard film I saw was King Lear. I'm even wondering, okay, like I'm looking at pictures of it. I was sure I saw it. Yeah, now I'm questioning myself, because I thought that was where I saw Julie Delpy for the first time.
His King Lear is very much not like King Lear. It's definitely a Godard version.
Yeah, it's not set all Shakespearean and all that. So I now I've got myself questioning it. Anyways, the bottom line, yeah, from everything I know, he's a very influential person and a total blind spot for me. But I think it shows the importance of foreign films, because a lot of the directors, writers, producers that create content and art that we love, someone overseas may have had a huge impact on their career. So I think this just goes to show how important cinema is across the planet, and how it's important to be aware of stuff that's not just, you know, made in North Americas.
Yeah, so if you want to check out a French picture, French movies from the New Wave, check out Godard movies. I know some movies that are on my radar. Of course, his most well-known movie is Breathless. I mentioned Alphaville. There's also A Woman is a Woman. And there is Contempt. And then also Perrault La Feu. So I know those are some of his major pictures, and of course The Weeknd is another one that I've heard mentioned a lot from different critics, and so I'm hoping maybe in a year I could speak more into Godard.
Myself as well. Actually, interestingly, it was in Due Revenge that Talia Ryder said to, how can I not remember Hawk's first name? Anyways, the Hawk says, I'm going to go watch some Godard in the other room. Do you want to come? So he was actually referenced on a film this week.
He was, and I was actually going to try to bring that up during the review, but like usual, I forgot.
There's so much that's easy to forget. But one thing I did not forget was the reviews or the ratings that we gave to each film this week. So I'm going to quickly run down that. First movie, Do Revenge. Both Chris and I really, really liked this film. It looks at so many tropes and cliches, but does so knowingly and still provides a freshness. I gave it 3.5 stars. Chris gave it 3. But he did give 3.5 to The Woman King, a movie that I didn't get to see. But Viola Davis, if anything that this tells me, is she is even more well-rounded than I had even given her credit for before this film. Then End of the Road, a movie with Queen Latifah and Ludacris. Lots of not-so-great elements about it. We disagreed on star rating, but very similar on our views of the film. I gave it 1. Chris liked Queen Latifah and Ludacris more. Well, not it helped him more swallow. It was the spoonful of sugar. They were the spoonful of sugar that helped his medicine go down. So I gave it 1 star. He gave it 2. And then it was Look Both Ways, a movie, what if this happened, and a film that really relied on Lily Reinhart to carry it and hold it together instead of just actually a captivating story. And lastly, 13 Lives, the Amazon Prime movie that was directed by Ron Howard. Excellent acting, but the highlight, the big praise for me is just the technical aspects, the filming, the audio, all of that so well done, because so much of the film is people swimming through cave passages, and goodness, is it executed really, really well. Reminds me of Rush, also by Ron Howard. And one of the biggest elements in Rush was that visual and the feel, especially when the cars were turning on for the first time right before a race, and you felt it in your body. I think Ron Howard is really good at putting us in a physical environment, and he shows it here. I gave it 3.5 stars.
Yeah, so this week we've got 2 streaming movies that we think are worth your time, and Do Revenge and 13 Lives. And I really think, though, you should also go to the theater. It's worth it. And so I had a question of the week already for you great listeners. And then I did a pivot this weekend. I've changed the question of the week, which really none of you would have known if I didn't just bring that up right now. But this one is less about sort of movies and more about sort of how you want us to do the show going forward. Because I want to know, do you want us to keep solo reviews for theatrical releases? So many, 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 many years ago, Scott didn't go to the theater as often as I, but when I went to the theater, I still would do a quick review of the movies that I did see. And then when Scott went up north where he had no access to the theater, that basically was a weekly occurrence. I would always do solo reviews. When Scott came back to a place that had a movie theater, we sort of decided, well, the solo reviews, it lacks discussion, it can make the shows longer, so let's scrap them. And that was the decision that we made. I am curious, though, we've never really asked you guys, do you want us to cover as many theatrical movies as possible? And if so, that means sometimes they'll have to be solo reviews. So I would love to hear your answer this week if that is something you want. And you can do that by email, themoviebreakdown@gmail.com. as well. You can check out this thing called Twitter. And on there, you can find us at Movie Breakdown 1. And while you're there, you can follow us and we will tweet at you. And then we've got facebook.com/@themoviebreakdown. And so you can join our Facebook page and we can Facebook at you. And then after you've done all that, you can subscribe to us and rate us on such places as Spreaker Prime, Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to your podcast. So do that. It really helps us in the algorithms. It lets us grow. If you want to continue to do more shows for you, that's the biggest way you can help us out. Spread the word. Let other people know about the show. And that would be fantastic. And another thing that you can help us out is checking out our website, Beyond the Balcony. And you can get there at beyondbalcony.com. We definitely have that horror article that Scott's already mentioned. I've got some revisits for you. Scott does something a little bit different. He talks about the Michelin star rating and if it matters. So food is now coming on the show. We've got the latest punishment movie review in Daddy Day Camp, which made Everett's heart sing. He was so happy to know that Scott despised it.
Scott did despise it. Scott absolutely did despise it. So he's going to take that as a win, and I'm taking it as a loss.
After I read the review to Everett, and a huge devious smile came over his face, Danica did shout from the other room, "But Scott's going to love my movie!" So it's a different game, that one. It's a different game. I'm not trusting that you will like it.
I'm going to craft it so that she can read it. Don't you know, we've got interesting movies next week that we're going to talk about, as well as the Olivia Wilde directed Don't Worry, Darling. Now, Olivia Wilde directed Booksmart, which was an absolutely amazing movie from 2019, starring Beanie Feldstein and Caitlin Dever. And this time, she's got someone who's equally as good as those other two in Florence Pugh starring in it. So that, I think, is going to be a real winner. And as well, we have Allison Janney and Journey Smollett starring in the thriller Lou. Definitely stuff you should come back for next week. I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Because you know how much the star-driven thriller connected with us this week.
Yeah, I know. Actually, you're right. Darn it.
I do want to apologize. There were no storms or no lightning. There was no thunder. That might be things you were hoping for. You didn't get to hear those, but you probably hear something loud in the background. And little do maybe some of you know, we've been having renovations in our house for over a year now. And so these noises have potentially been showing up on several episodes. But right now, he's moved to a room that's very close to where I record the podcast. And so it's probably louder than ever. And so I just want to apologize. Yes, I hear the noise that you heard this week.
It's not some sort of auditory hallucination that you're having. We are admitting the noise actually does exist.
Maybe I should have done the reverse. It's all in your mind. It's happening in your house.
Yeah, I know, dear listener, I know that right now you believe you're hearing sounds that actually there, and I want to confirm that they're not there, because we have that disclaimer every week.
That's right. But what will be there is next week's episode, so please join us next week. Thank you so much for joining us this week. I'm Christopher Spicer,
and I'm Scott Martin. Take care, everyone,
and have a great week at the movies. Thank you.